Our topic for philosteopathy this month was myofascial pain syndrome. This concept has been around since the 1960s. We discussed some of the possible etiologies from the Travel trigger points to overuse syndromes, range of motion loss, autoimmune disease, low vitamin D, the side effects of statin drugs, straining the fascial system with poor posture, and psycho-emotional trauma. We spoke about how chronic myofascial pain may lead to central sensitization, a cycle of negative emotions and thoughts, reiterating the narrative of your pain. The thoughts of, I am damaged, I am broken, or I cannot get better, being played over and over in one's head. An important aspect of addressing our patients' myofascial pain is listening to their words and observing their behavior and slowly addressing their fears if they are ready. This often means addressing their pain with many different modalities such as manipulation or injections. Although the keystone to a positive outcome seems to be empowering the patient to take ownership of their health, to change their identity. Enjoy the conversation on myofascial pain.
Welcome back, everyone, for Philosteopathy.
We're back.
We're back. So, Mick Bora is here. I'll say that I'm a third-year resident again, and rounding out my training with the OMM program at Michigan State University. And we have a guest med student.
I'm Madison Lambert. I'm from Lafayette, Louisiana. I'm a fourth year at AFOM, Louisiana. I'm here for an elective at the MSU OMM clinic. Happy to be here.
I'm Ben Green, third-year OMM resident at MSU.
And then we have our two outstanding attending physicians with us. We have Dr. O'Connor and Dr. Guasco. You guys want to add your own little quick resume?
Okay, yes, I am Jesse Guasco. I'm faculty here at Michigan State University in the departments of OMM and psychiatry. Happy to be here as well.
And I'm Dr. Ryan O'Connor, also faculty at Michigan State University. Department of Physical Medicine Rehabilitation.
Awesome. So we've this group's met a couple times. I'm sure if there are any common listeners, you'd know that. But today we're going to talk about myofascial pain, and more specifically myofascial pain syndrome, which is could be a pseudonym, it could be a misnomer, or it could be an accurate sort of term to label what we're going to discuss today. But basically, kind of, where does pain come from in regards to fascia, and how do we treat it? What's the best way to treat it and approach it, or to even, I guess, perceive it? So we did read an article from the NCBI, but it wasn't really too informative. I don't know if anyone has anything they want to say on it first, but for me, I was kind of hoping to see a little bit more of the pathophysiology, and maybe you guys can talk about where we have pain receptors within the fascial system.
One of my confusions and why I was interested in this topic, and Dr. O'Connor and I had talked about it, is that I don't really understand when someone has myofascial pain syndrome, what exactly that means. Is that simply I find a really tight muscle, and so the skeletal muscle is hypertonic, and when I press on it, it reproduces pain. So is there also then some fascia involved? And it's just, I was confused, honestly. And so this was an opportunity to bring together the OMM minds to kind of discuss it, OMM and PM&R, and discuss it a little bit more and tap into your clinical experience.
Yeah, so that's a good point. Myofascial pain syndrome, and it's definitely not a new term. It really began, you know, the term kind of comes out of the 1960s and 70s, and then gained a lot of fervor in the 80s and into the 90s. And, you know, it, in itself, we always kind of wonder, is it its own disease process, or is it, you know, related to other disease processes that present with pain in myofascial distribution? So that's, you know, that's kind of where it started out. It was kind of believed in my training, which was in the 1990s, we almost considered it its own clinical entity, like it's almost its own disease. It had its own diagnostic code and, you know, and there were treatment parameters and how you manage it and, you know, different ways to treat it. And there wasn't as much emphasis as, you know, what other sources could be contributing to pain of myofascial structures. They were referenced somewhat, and so it was therefore somewhat considered a diagnosis of exclusion. So yeah, so talking in general about myofascial pain. So myofascial pain syndrome is not really a new concept. It's not a concept or something that's really just been birthed in the past 10, 15 years. It really developed historically, probably even before the 1950s and 60s, but around then it became a lot more popular. In the 1970s and 80s, there was medical practitioners and therapists that would treat it. One of them was Dr. Janet Travell. She's the physician that, along with Dr. David Simons, wrote the Trigger Point Manual, which is basically a textbook on myofascial pain and how to manage it. And it was interesting, and they had their theories at, you know, in that book at what was causing it. And one of them was these quote-unquote trigger points that they kind of coined, but we all used decades later. And their main view was that these trigger points were caused by these taut, T-A-U-T. That's the first time I ever remember hearing, really learning that word, was coming out of the Trigger Point Manual, that taut, hyper-irritable band. And, you know, and that's, you know, and it causes the muscle to shorten, to send a referral zone. So then there was a zone where this tight band would then cause distal pain at a different referral site. That was pretty much the blueprint that we followed even pretty much through the 90s and into the 2000s. And, you know, some of that is all still very true and very relevant. And the treatments that are employed for myofascial pain, we still do today, including some of the techniques that Dr. Travell and Dr. Simons put in their textbook and their work. In fact, this week I've employed some of those techniques on patients. But our understanding of not just neuroanatomy, but chemopathogens and nociceptive understanding of what causes pain has really grown over the past 10 or 15 years. And so our understanding of quote-unquote myofascial pain, potentially as its own entity, but also potentially as it relates to other disease processes, has really expanded since the work of Travell and Simons.
How it relates to other disease processes, yeah.
What other medical things do you guys think of when it comes to etiology of myofascial sort of pain?
What do we think about?
Yeah, I mean, what kind of things have you seen in the literature?
I mean, when Dr. Connor was talking about that taut band of tissue, what came to mind immediately was like a fascial trigger band, you know, you learn about in like the fascial distortion.
Thank you.
Fascial trigger points or herniated trigger points, also thinking in the fascial distortion model. Overuse syndromes, I correlate that to potentially causing.
That's in the literature too.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very common.
Fascial pain syndromes.
And what was interesting about Travell and the Trigger Point Manual is that they were very big on that referral zone, meaning that if you have a taut band and you touch, the way I understood it when I was in training, if you pressed and touched on that taut band, you might feel it at a distance, and you push there and the patient goes, oh yeah, I just felt that radiate down to there. So that happens sometimes, but I don't take that as literal today. As it was, as I learned, you know, when I read that book 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Some of the other things were weakness of the muscle group, right?
Weakness.
Range of motion loss, mm-hmm. right? Which are some of the
other etiologies?
Well, just like the symptomatology.
Manifestations.
Yeah, exactly.
Eat some food. We got lots of food here. It's good food.
It's good.
But I was thinking other medical reasons why myofascia might be irritable.
Oh, okay. Like rheumatoid, inflammatory diseases.
Right.
Maybe even CHF overloading with that third spacing of the tissues.
I've seen low vitamin D levels.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Statin drugs.
Ooh, statins with, yeah.
Toxic
myopathy.
Toxins. Yeah. Things that make you hurt. But vitamin D is huge, especially in Michigan. In Louisiana, where you're from, you don't have vitamin D deficiency, most likely.
I guess it depends on some people how long they spend indoors and such.
I suspect that's true. I never knew it existed until I moved to Michigan.
It is ramping up here, that's for sure.
We have two newcomers with us as well. I want to just introduce them. Go ahead, either of you, at the same time. Do it.
Hi.
Yeah, they did.
Jordan Little. Ichiwai-1, new ornament resident here at MSU.
Hi, Nicole Wong, and also an intern.
Which is?
Intern.
Great.
Stellar intern.
Welcome aboard.
So, did we exhaust what we know about the etiology, like the medical causes, like what Dr. Glasgow was asking?
Well, that might be medical. What about the other things? You said overuse?
Overuse.
Well,
fascial trigger band. Talking about
trauma.
Trauma.
Trauma. Yeah.
Trauma.
Why not? Like a. Sure. How much it ripples throughout the body?
I mean, think about the posturing of someone who's chronically depressed.
Yeah. So the late effects from a trauma could absolutely, because then, you know, when you talk about trauma and injury and insult. And myofascial pain, you want to separate out the phases from acute to subacute to chronic. When it gets to be chronic, what you're saying is then all of a sudden you get these postural changes that occur secondary to a remote injury that's already gone through its quote-unquote tissue healing process. So that acute phase is gone, the tissue healing is gone, the edema is probably gone, at least a visible edema. And then, but then you still have this broken record, nociception pain. You still have these little abnormal somatic dysfunctions, if I can use that word, that can affect your posture, and then that can contribute on and on and on. So yeah, postural changes, I think, are a big part of myofascial pain, especially in the chronic phases of it.
So on a blanket term, safe to say that any sort of strain on the fascial system is going to cause some sort of fascial disruption, fascial pain, fascial whatever. But... Can I go to that question I originally asked the table, but our two attending specifically? So with the perceived sense of pain, we know we have the lateral tracts in the spine, we have the dorsal column, that's how it travels up to this cerebral system to actually be registered as pain. We have our, on the peripheral aspect, like the free nerve endings, your Ruffini, Corpuscle, Meissner, and all those, you know, sort of sensory aspects. Where is the relay system occurring? Is it being sensed immediately from the peripheral, and then does it travel up the lateral? Does it travel up the dorsal? Because there's all those regions that they
say
they
travel up both in some cases.
Oh, it can? Okay.
Yeah, so, you know, pressure has a different little pathway, then light touch has a different little pathway, and temperature has, you know, the spinal thalamic tracts. And some of those can cause pain, like, you know, scalding hot temperature, right? Pinprick. That's all a slightly different pathway.
But fascia is not really... Is it all of them?
It really is. So it depends. Yeah. So the sensory, so these large nerves are getting stimulated. And within those nerves, you've got your pressure, your temperature, your primary nociceptive afferents, and this and that, your small fibers, your unmyelinated fibers, your C5. So the pain, the C-fibers and the alpha-delta fibers and the different breakdowns of the different pain fibers kind of travel through different pathways in the cord, then they cross over in synapse to end up, you know, into the cord, you know, through the cortical system. And then to the, and then from there, it goes to the vascular system, the behavioral aspect of it, and the presentation then that how you feel, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the fascinating things about it is that a lot of these, you said the etiology is like overuse, and these are, we talked about a lot of physical things, but I mean, in a lot of the literature, you're going to look at myofascial pain, and you guys already know this, so much of it comes out in the psychological one, right? So, like their, what their past trauma history is, or what their emotional status is, or what sort of a major events they've just gone through, all those sort of things. A myofascial system that is under stress, and that irritability and the sensation change.
Hmm.
And what, some of the other things I've read have been that, like, the myofascial system specifically can be, is almost easier to get the centralization process or centralized pain process than other aspects of the body. And that is, you know, so that thing that perpetuates the system. Like he had mentioned, Dr. O'Connor gets up to the behavioral aspect, and then all of the things you do, all the behaviors you have, all the emotions you have about your pain, all the narrative you have about your pain, all of that then has this like feed forward process. It just kind of stimulates it even more.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, you know, like we had talked about trauma and the late stages of trauma, like physical trauma. Let's say you had a car accident or something like that. Then you get into this, you know, you irritate the muscles and the tissue, right? And we see that in our clinics a lot in acute, from a fall or injury or whatever. But after it goes on for a few weeks or longer, and you said the tissue healing has occurred, you've already, edema's gone, and the tissue, like, damage is actually healed now. The perpetuation of a process, a thought process that I'm damaged, or that my back is actually still injured, or that there's, you know, my back is shot, or all these different things, contribute to a body that changes its form because it's constantly trying to hold on to a state of, you know, safety, right? So, like, you may hold yourself in certain ways. You see the people that get off the table by holding their, you know, they have to push themselves up or whatever because they don't want to put too much strain on their body. All of those things are feed-forward factors in this perpetuation of the pain process. So, and we really see that in the myofascial system. It's almost like stays tight, you know?
Yeah.
And then it's not like they mean for that to happen, but that's just what happens. So I find that fascinating because it really plays a big part of this, I think.
Oh, that is very fascinating.
This is the most important part of this talk, what he just said right now, I think, because when you have trauma, you know, from musculoskeletal trauma or other trauma, but tying in that whole behavioral manifestation and how that can affect myofascial pain, one of the, so let's say somebody has a car accident and they have a really bad whiplash, they have neck pain, they have sprained arm, they've got bruising, ligament injuries, you want to get down to the tissue, there's all sorts of subluxations and other things that occur that can contribute to pain. But they were, you know, the thing that they also have is that they're pretty scared sometimes. You know, a couple weeks go by, they have anxiety, they're not sleeping well, they're having dreams. Every time that they come to a stoplight, they feel something like squeezing in their upper back and neck region. And that's interesting. So you could look at it as a form of PTSD potentially. Now that PTSD is interesting because we think about PTSD of having, you know, really bad feelings and bad memories and anxiety about something bad that happened. Well, what if you had those same feelings and memories, but the same pain structures that were involved initially could be then reactivated and you feel those again, real pain. Not just mental anguish and anxiety.
So real pain again. Then how would you distribute? Oh, yeah, okay. So, really, what that sounds like to me is back to kind of square one of how complicated pain really is, and especially with articulating it with the patient. So on our end, we're able to kind of listen to what the patient's saying, start developing this sort of, I guess, pathophysiological picture for each individual patient. But it's really, really challenging to articulate that to a patient. I've tried with saying things kind of back to what you were saying with, you know, power of perception is incredible. You view yourself as broken. Your body's going to behave as broken. And I try to go about that with highlighting ways in which perception is noticeable. You know, that, forget, it's, I think the phenomenon has a name, but when you're buying a brand new car and you like that one car, you end up seeing it everywhere you go because you're hyper-focusing on it. So it's the same thing with, that's what I try to start talking about with patients is if you start hyper-focusing on, like, viewing yourself as that way, your body, whether or not you think that pain is real or not, your body is going to start behaving as such because that's just how you're functioning at that point. Does that make sense? See, this is where I kind of fall apart with my patients because I'm like, I'm hoping it makes sense because I know on our end, we have all these reasons why it's painful,
but then we also have that limbic related system. It's this purely emotionally memory driven, and that's where your pain is truly central. Do we have a peripheral aspect to it? Is there both? So I don't know.
I don't think you have to draw a line in the sand.
Okay,
because I think what that does is that silos you into a particular way of thinking, and it silos, I think it creates a rift between you and your patient if they're not thinking the same way.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So, and I used to be like that, like hardcore. It's like, okay, this is either like a mental process that we need to work on, or this is a physical process, right?
Yeah.
And that's very, pain's not that, it's more complicated than that, right? So mm-hmm. It's both of those things, most likely.
Yeah.
And I think the fun of this can be that you really try to figure out the people you're working with through their words, and really even more so through their behavior. How much of communication is non-verbal, right?
Yeah.
Right. So much through their behavior, how they move, and that's what we pick up as osteopaths, right? We're looking at how they get on and off the table, how they shift in their conversation with you about what they're talking about. Not just the words, but what they're actually doing. But even through their words, like what their narrative is, okay? So what are the important things that they're missing in their life because of this pain? What do they actually think is wrong with them? Like all of these different things. And if you can get a sense of like some of the bigger aspects of the functional limitations that they have, or the fears that they have, and be able to work on those specific things.
Okay.
And you can do that through treatment of any type, whether you're gonna do trigger point injections, or you're gonna be, you know, treating their body with OMT and try to improve their range of motion, all that sort of stuff. And also talking about like how can we work on these fear related behaviors.
Yeah.
At least fear related cognitions and behaviors.
No, I like that because it allows for that change in perception as well. So if you're just working based off that functional aspect, and then you show moderate or even just a little bit of progress towards that, then there's that correlation, and then goes back to the mind, and there's positive reaffirmation. So that's, yeah, okay, I like that.
Yeah, and again, like, everybody's gonna be in a different place, so some people might be very on board, they're gonna know, like, oh yeah, they'll say it right to you, like, I know that my, like, stress and anxiety make this way worse, I'm afraid to do this, that, and the other thing, and that's your way in, like, you know, I mean, then you can have that conversation with them.
Okay.
Some people may be much more, like, not there, right, they might be much more in a mechanical state, and you can work with that from where they're at. But you'll probably be able to find out very shortly that, like, by asking them some questions about the things that they do and the way they you know, think about their particular activities, that there's probably fear in there, right?
Yeah.
Or that there's probably, like, they know, they'll say that stress does make it worse or whatever.
Yeah.
And that might be a slow way in where you can kind of work from there.
Yeah.
Some of the biggest things I've seen, even some of the pain reprocessing therapy stuff that I've talked to in the past about, I'm not sure if I've talked to, we talked about this last time, sorry, but how cognitions and fear and that sort of, all those things trigger, you know, how your pain processing is. The relationship that they have with their provider is one of the most important ways that they get better. Okay? So if you are not creating that line, like, I'm just going to treat this and I'm not going to pay attention to these other things, and you are listening to them and you're attending to their different, you know, their different states, and you're empathic, like, all those things create a therapeutic relationship that people end up getting better because of that. Okay.
It's also a fine line to walk because I don't have a better term for it, but there's the dementor patients, the one that come in and they're always broken, they're always miserable, the world's just constantly crushing them, they have no responsibility for their pain, it's never their fault or never their job to get better.
Yes.
You know, so it's like, how do you walk that line with those ones?
Well, you're not gonna change people from that standpoint, okay? I think, again, the relationship that you're creating with these people is you're trying to, let's put it this way, if it's all passive treatment,
yeah,
right, they come in, they get injections, or they just get OMT or whatever they get, right, that almost perpetuates the process, right, because they have no onus on themselves to do anything.
Yeah.
But if you start adding in this component of listening to their story and trying to get a sense of, like, their thoughts, their behaviors, all these different things, and how all this interplays.
Yeah.
Now they have things that they have to be able to address or work on. If they don't, and they're like, this person's crazy, like, then they won't come back to you. But, like, when you start to shift it into like a, like their self-efficacy starts to improve as you start to like get them involved in their care a lot more, you know what I mean? And there's actually some evidence out there to support like that people that are more engaged in their treatment are pretty happy about their treatment overall because they feel like it's more well-rounded as opposed to just, you know, like a one and done sort of thing or just like a passive treatment.
And you were talking about that the other day, Dr. O'Connor.
Locus of control. Locus of control.
Yes! Interlocus of control.
Yeah. I know there was a term that came out in the 1950s, and I'm trying to think of the psychiatrist or psychologist that coined it, but it was in the 50s, if I recall. Not that I was alive then, but I heard about it. But it was, but that's you know, a really huge concept of what Dr. Guasco was just describing as well, is that patients that are empowered and that feel like they can influence the outcome of anything, including their pain, their disease, their role in society, and every other factor. So if you can take ownership and increase, you know, your what the phrase is, locus of control, you will have more, you know, positive, beneficial outcomes, you know, in every type of endeavor that you may have, including your own health and pain. And that is such a huge thing because we all deal with chronic pain patients who, you know, have significant pathology, and yes, they've had some bad luck, for no other better term, and reasons, they have plenty of reasons to have a lot of anxiety, depression, and, you know, somatic problems. But in addition to just treating them, treating their disease, treating their nerve, you know, that's inflamed, or their disc that's herniated, or their rib that's out of alignment, we do need to empower them. We need to get them to buy in so that they believe that they can take ownership of their condition, and it certainly will help their outcome.
Yeah, it's like an art of medicine right there. What are you going to add?
I was going to add one more thing in relation to what you had mentioned, Dr. Juarez, about the these patients who almost like they have no locus of control whatsoever, right?
Yeah.
And it's like they put it all on you to do what you need to do and fix them or whatever it might be. And they, how many times do you hear that? Like, fix me sort of thing, right?
Oh,
yeah. And I mean, we know now through a lot of fMRI imaging and a lot of sophisticated studies and techniques these days that, like, the frontal lobe changes so significantly in pain and persistent pain conditions that their locus of control almost gets lost from a physiologic standpoint, right?
Oh,
so
that's
interesting. Like, yeah, so, like, you may be skirting the line of, like, personality disorder sort of stuff, maybe. But on the broader sense, I would pay more attention to the fact that, like, their brain is actually changing, their executive functioning is changing. It's almost like depression. It looks like that.
Yeah.
So, like, they are going to almost have a learned helplessness because everything they do reinforces their pain again, right?
Yeah.
So if you take it from that standpoint and say, okay, let's figure out some of the major factors here that are perpetuating this process and see if we can work on specific things.
Hmm.
So that might be a graded exercise sort of program, or you know, what are the things you enjoy doing? You don't do those anymore. Let's see if we can maybe get back to doing some of those things, right? In a very slow way that feels safe to them, right? As you work on them and you're doing these different things, right?
Mm.
That's what we do in depression.
Mm.
We call it behavioral activation. Somebody cannot, they literally can't do anything. They're stuck.
Mm-hmm.
You find the smallest thing, and you work. From there, yes,
and
it just gets the ball rolling, right?
Huh, I never really, I knew one from an experiential level, a personal empirical level, but then obviously from patients, how much chronic pain can weigh on the psyche, but I guess I never really looked at it as now being a, almost like a, I don't want to use that word, I'm going to use the word, it's scientific, a retardation of your brain's ability to function in a normal sense, I guess. It's literally going to change your behavior. So I guess I should have. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, and that's another great point that Dr. Guasco brings up. So these are, you know, this is like brain damaging changes that occur in the neural networking and the frontal lobe and the sensory cortex and some of the other behavioral centers that occur as a result of you know, all the adverse and unpleasant input and stimuli. But one of the things that we have learned in, you know, really more in recent years than in the past, in the past, including when I was early in my training, we used to think that the brain didn't have much neuroplasticity unless you were very young. If you were a child, you had some neuroplasticity, you could recover pretty good, and that was about it. And if you had a brain injury when you were older, you just got to deal with it, and then you just got to get therapy to keep your, you know, to kind of stay par without actually regressing. But I think now there's evidence suggesting that even as adults, even as an 80-year-old, you may possess the ability for neuroplasticity. So if that's, because I was listening to this, I was listening to one of these like self-help things in the morning on the way to work, you know, these little 30-minute podcasts of all these different issues and how to make your life better. And so I'm listening to this, and this doctor is talking about neuroplasticity and how you can actually have new networks, re-network yourself, and actually have gain of function in certain aspects of your life and cognitive abilities. That's right, I was listening to the anti-aging stuff. That's right, the David Sinclair crowd, that's what I was listening to. So I'm thinking about this. I'm in my car, it's like, I don't know, 5 o'clock in the morning, I get to work early, I'm listening to this, thinking to myself, you know what? That's really interesting, because even though, you know, we potentially, the patients that have that chronic behavior changes, and that chronic pain changes that occurs on the neural system, we may be able to help rewire that as well. We may be able to foster that neuroplasticity so that no matter how desolate or bad their actual pain syndrome is, that also could potentially change, metabolically speaking, and functionally, to where their condition improves. So, you know, and it's another thing too, is like we used to think, well, you know, there's no use treating somebody with such and such a pain syndrome because it's already in their brain. And there's not much you can do about it, but hit them with a bunch of serotonin and dopamine reuptake inhibitors and other drugs like that. But now I think, you know, and maybe it's a nutritious thing. Maybe it's, you know, maybe it's other things. But maybe there's ways to actually, you know, really change the plasticity of the brain that will help pain. And I think, you know, long term, I think that's going to be really, really important in the future of pain management. Because our patients are living longer. The first person to live to 150 has probably already been born.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't really want to spend those last 20, 30, 40, 50 years in a very arthritic, painful process. And if there's anything that we can do to help improve not just our cognitive health, but our pain health as we get older, it's a good idea.
So, before I segue, does anyone else have any sort of comments to put on that? I know you guys have been, feel free.
So one is, and I think you've had a guest on your podcast, Ben, that's talked about this, maybe Dr. Gordon, about how patients will identify with their pain. And it becomes like part of their identity, and so they hold on to it, and they don't know how to be without pain, because it's just how they've lived for so long. And so that becomes a whole other level of difficulty of unlearning that. And so they learn how to not live in their body in certain ways, because they're so attached to the pain that they have to mold themselves around it. And so in that aspect, looking at different therapies, like you were saying, and approaches, I think embodiment practices or like mindful awareness is probably very important. Just getting people to identify like, oh, okay, this is what it feels like to put my attention on my foot or my hand or those places in my body that I completely ignore because I'm in so much pain all the time. I'm focused on the pain or something to get my mind out of it. So I just think that's an interesting way to look at it.
Absolutely. And I think
I was just going to say, I think there's like a need for us to help our patients shift their perspective of what self-care actually is. Like when I say self-care, like what are you doing for self-care? Some of our patients will say like, oh, I haven't gone to the spa or I haven't got a massage in a while or I'm just going on a vacation or something. And like self-care is not it's not supposed to be those things, because those are like escapes from our life. Yeah. Real self-care is like taking steps to build a life that you feel like you don't have to escape from. And like that's how we should be encouraging our patients to actually care about themselves. Like, there's the whole idea of like, learning to sharpen your knife or sharpen your tools so that when you go to actually do something that's stressful, that you have more ability, more capability to handle that stress.
That's a great point. I like that.
That's a great point.
Yeah, no, the whole identity issue with pain as well. You know, what you were, Dr. Juarez was alluding to, it's like, you know, you do become, you know, it becomes part of your identity and your self-awareness. It's like, I am a person who has this pain, and that's who I am. That's how I identify my whole life. And you think about it, you know, I mean, there are certain conditions that change your self-identity, like, instantly. Like, let's say you wake up one day and you have stage 4 cancer. You are now a cancer patient, and pretty much that's how you're identifying yourself through your friends, family circles, your coworkers. From that point on, you are now the cancer patient. And you know, and that's, some of that is really not easy to remedy until you overcome that. But some of the more silent things that aren't as apparent is, you know, I'm an accident victim. I'm a survivor of you know, abuse. You know, and so I think if we can identify those patients, reset their neural networking, it can really help their pain and other things.
Yeah, which, so because we kind of keep talking about resetting neural networking, you guys might find this interesting, and I encourage you, anyone and anyone listening, to take a look at the article and research that came out. But recently, two surgeons actually, for the first time ever, they took a quadriplegic man in the United States, and they utilized microchips at the cerebral aspect of the brain, and they placed one at the peripheral aspect of the body. And using an AI with whatever sort of coding algorithm that it has, they were basically able to teach this man how to think about feeling in his arm, how to think about moving his arm, and the AIs from one end to the other was basically remapping that neural pathway, and they developed the ability to reuse and feel from that arm. So I do think you're absolutely correct that we are figuring out how to remap the neurons. We're figuring out how to use tools to do that, because the AI system apparently is the one who's doing all the legwork. But it was coded, so.
That's a great, I think I came across something like that, but yeah, but AI and neural, you know, neural mapping, I mean, we're jumping out, so it's kind of a segue, so I think we're about to enter a phase, I'll see it at the tail end of my career, but you guys are going to see it in yours, where there's going to be a lot more of implantable and interface technology that's bio-embedded inside of all of us.
Yeah.
And it's going to give us all sorts of information and data, some of which will be helpful and useful for maintaining our lifespan and increasing our lifespan. Some of it will be helpful in minimizing our pain. Some of it may be less than desirable in what it does to society.
Yeah.
But
Black Mirror stuff.
But it is out of the box. There's no turning
it
back.
It is out of the box.
There's no turning back. You know, I think we're all going to have some sort of an implant in 10 or 20 years.
Oh, yeah. What were you going to say, Dr. Green?
I'm trying to figure out how to tie all this together.
Well, I did have one way because...
Well, go ahead. Tile that.
So I wonder, I totally agree with you, Dr. O'Connor. I think AI is knocking at our door currently. Trying to tie in what you talked about, AI, neuroplasticity, and reprogramming our central nervous system. I had an experience with a patient this week who has had chronic neck pain, which she describes as tightness, for almost 40 years. No inciting accident. And she was telling me how the pain is 8 out of 10 when she experiences it. But when she crochets, it's a zero. And so in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, well, there's And let me back up a little bit. She did have a CVA, right CVA. She had a TIA. She had vasculitis, which was currently in remission since like 2008. So she had some structural things that had happened to her historically. But it was so interesting to me that when she was doing something that she absolutely loved, like crocheting, the neck pain was zero. And she said, what did she say? So I thought to myself, well, how can we kind of do this reprogramming process? And I said, maybe when you start experiencing that pain, imagine that you are crocheting. Imagine, and just journal or let me know what does your neck pain now feel like. And then I went and I told Dr. Guasco this. I'm like, Dr. Guasco, I had this patient, you know, I did this. And he asked me, he's like, did you walk through the patient in the moment, in the patient encounter, and try to recreate that scene of them crocheting and ask them, what did their neck pain feel like? And if it goes away, then maybe that's a way, a very specific, concrete way for them to reprogram and break those nociceptive pathways and decrease maybe that central sensitization. Yeah. And maybe in that case, we're kind of taking the place of AI, which is not, well, I guess they can do it now, but...
Apparently.
You know, yeah. We don't have AI in our clinic, but we can be doing that.
We could.
So...
No, that's actually very interesting. Maybe that'd be fun to play around with how to actually incorporate that.
You know, that's a great... I do little tricks sometimes when I'm talking with patients. If I'm doing a painful procedure, some of the procedures I do aren't the most comfortable in the world. And I'm doing it for pain. But if I see a patient that's, you know, experiencing anxiety or squeamishing or having real discomfort for what I'm doing, which it makes me feel bad, then I'm actually, you know, if you don't do something to help them, I still don't want them to suffer through the process. So I like to redirect them sometimes, you know, mentally redirect them. I'll talk about, a lot of times I'll try to ask them about their children. And it's amazing, all of a sudden, how you could take their pancreas out and they wouldn't blink when they're talking about their kids. And as if it's an older patient, their grandkids. It turns out that that's the one thing that really, patients over 60 or 50, depending upon, you know, what generation you have grandkids in, you know, that's another strong suit. That's what they're thinking about. That's a very important thing to them, biologically and life, socially. So once I had to redirect like that, you know, I do this when I'm doing EMGs on patients, because we all sticking needles in me, shocking me. And I have a whole chat about their entire family, and next thing I know, I'm done with the exam.
Okay. Huh. The distraction test. Well, that was, I mean, we did bounce all over the place. I guess I kind of took us on some tangents there, but... I do think pain is just a phenomenon that I do feel like we know very little about. It's supposed to be protective, it is responsive, there's all these reasons why we want to feel pain, but then we can get stuck in a state in which we don't need to feel pain, and I'm not quite convinced we're fully aware of what all of those are yet and how to actually treat them best. We've just covered how it can be from manipulative medicine to taking a Cymbalta to some sort of injectional therapy with steroids or even a rhizotomy, changing the structural aspect of their neuroanatomy. So, I mean, it's just all these multiple varying ways to treat the one same thing, pain. So, I don't know, I just figured I'd end it on that, but whatever you want to add.
Yeah. I don't think we ever really find it. If you had to conceptualize like myofascial pain as that one concept, either Dr. Guasco, Dr. O'Connor, how would you define it, and what are the defining characteristics? They talk about trigger points in this article.
Yeah.
Is one of the defining characteristics of myofascial pain.
So
maybe you could bring in the structural, maybe you could bring in the spiritual, mental.
Well, just to kind of, you know, just to kind of define it, okay, it's, you know, it can be, you know, you have to kind of, even while defining it, you still have to kind of categorize it. It can be
localized or regionalized.
Yeah.
So it may not be systemic. It can be local. It can be, you know, limited to a limb or limited to a, you know, to your lower back or your neck region. You know, and then you want to think about it in terms of chronicity, acute or subacute or chronic. So, like other, you know, more direct causes of pain that we think of direct, or somebody who has, you know, rheumatologic disease, disease of the synovium and their fingers, and they got tophi and this and all this swelling and all these really bad autoimmune things. It can be, you know, limited to their hands. It can be all over. So we want to kind of define it. So I basically pretty much think it would be relating to, you know, as far as tissue origin, pain that you are conceptualizing, you know, in the skin, soft tissue, muscle, even tendon, ligament to some area, if you want to get periarticular around the joint. But, you know, to have its own, to be more with the muscle being the sun of it. It's the, you know, that's the kind of the region of where, you know, where it's felt, where the pain is expressed. And then depending upon, is it all throughout your body? Is it other regions and zones? You know, that's kind of, so that's how I look at myofascial pain. Now, if you want to talk about etiologies, you know, of what is actually causing it, there, you know, that's where you really got to do due diligence. And I highly recommend, you know, anybody that you're evaluating for chronic pain, the rheumatologists are very good at this. You know, they're going to take 6 tubes of blood out of them. You know, in Michigan, everybody gets the vitamin D level just from walking in the door, because we know that's going to be an issue most likely. And treating it is very helpful. So you want to look for treatable causes, you know, with disease processes, other toxicities. You have to look at, you know, is there a visceral origin of their pain? I saw a patient today with chronic abdominal pain. Now, you're probably saying, what's a physical medicine interventional pain specialist doing with somebody with chronic abdominal pain? Well, chances are I'm not the first doctor they've seen for that. They've already gone through the $1 million GI workup. They've seen all the other specialists as well. They've had their gallbladder out there. They had their appendix out. They've been put on, you know, the gluten-free diet, all of that, other medications, this and that. And so ultimately, the patient was referred to me because somebody, I think it was in the rheumatology clinic or someone, had diagnosed the patient with a condition called ACNES, or anterior cutaneous nerve entrapment syndrome, ACNES. It's like fibromyalgia of your stomach, right? Huh. So it really hits the rib costal margins, the xiphoid processes, the mid-epigastric area. Very, very unpleasant thing to have, very difficult to have. Everyone's scratching their head as to why this is occurring. So what we're perceiving in that disease and disorder is that you have abnormal function of cutaneous nerves under the skin and right near muscle tissue. Now, the interesting thing about those cutaneous nerves is that you can see them under ultrasound. So you're an ultrasound guy, I'll show you. It's kind of interesting. And if I can see it under ultrasound and it's a structure, I can stick a needle in it. So that excites me. So, you know, again, you have to go through the process of what could be causing the pain. Obviously, you know, 99 out of 100 people that have abdominal pain, you know, they're not going to land on the diagnosis of anterior cutaneous nerve entrapment syndrome.
So when you're diagnosing,
I didn't even know what that was until about 3 years ago.
Yeah,
I'm 54.
So really, when you're diagnosing myofascial pain, you are touching the patient, trying to reproduce their pain, seeing where it refers.
I do. I definitely get my hands on. It's a, you know, you just can't sit there, you know, and you know, in a corporate medical clinic, like you touch a bell, 5 minutes in and out, what's wrong? Here's this script, there's your PT script, there's that, gotta go get my RVU, someone next to the next patient. You can't do that. You gotta spend time, you gotta listen to them, you gotta touch them. You know, you gotta get your clinics have to start getting behind because you're spending too much time with patients. People have to start getting mad at you a little bit. Then you know you're doing a good job.
That's how you know.
Unless you bring your nurses gifts, then by the lunch. Yeah, that was great. Anything, Dr. Guasco, you wanted to add? Any concluding remarks? Sum things up in any way?
No, I think from the psychological, behavioral side, your muscles, your myofascial system is your armor. You know, it is the protector, and it works without you knowing it.
Yeah.
It works with you knowing it. It works without you knowing it, and so that's why I say really start paying attention to the words that are being said and the things that are not being said, and how these people behave, and I think attuning to that is one of the most important features of building a relationship with a patient in terms of that therapeutic relationship. So.
Mm-hmm. That was a wonderful conversation.
That was fun.
Mind, body, spirit. It was good. Thanks everybody for participating.
Round.
And thank you, Dr. O'Connor, for sponsoring this dinner.
You are all welcome. Enjoy.
Sponsored by Dr. O'Connor.
Thank you, listeners.
Thank you.
Go Cougs.
Hope you enjoyed our conversation about myofascial pain. If you have any questions or would like to be on the podcast, email theonmmpodcast@gmail.com. Leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts and stay tuned for the next episode.